And welcome back. This is Susan, continuing with the Decatur Herald in review for Tuesday, July 12th, 2016. We'll continue with the reading of this article headlined "Strangling Death of Nurse in 1990 Ruled a Homicide." And taking up where we left off, the rope around her neck was not consistent with a suicidal hanging. Other indicators included a lack of a suicide note, her diary, which said nothing about her being depressed, and the fact that there were children in the house. "It would be unusual for a mother to do this with children in the house," he testified. "Her feet were bare and clean while she was found in the middle of the garage with a dirty floor. Fresh abrasions on her ankle and elbow seemed to indicate a sexual assault, the result of her body hitting on something hard. The bruising in the neck is totally inconsistent with hanging," Denton said, adding that a fingertip of a latex glove was found in a knot in the rope. She was not wearing gloves. The knot in back of her neck was so tight it actually broke blood vessels. Denton said Dr. Grant Johnson, who performed the original autopsy, was not trained in forensic pathology. He asked for outside help in the case and did not determine that it was a suicide. Rode said she remembers when she first heard about the case in 1990 when she was on a break from college. Shortly after she took office as the county's top prosecutor in 2008, she contacted the state police and met with them to discuss their investigation. "The state police is continuing to follow different leads and information," she said. "We need to follow up on all of them." And let's move now to the editorial page of the Herald and Review with this headlined editorial, "Attacks on Comey Undermine the Rule of Law." And this is an editorial by Dana Milbank. "Republicans summoned FBI Director James Comey to Capitol Hill on Thursday to question him about his determination that Hillary Clinton did not break the law with her use of a private email server. They termed it an emergency hearing, and their questions were correspondingly urgent. "Have you seen the Broadway production of Hamilton?" Representative John Micah of Florida, the most senior Republican on the House Oversight Committee, asked Comey. The witness looked puzzled at the line of questioning. Was Micah going to challenge him to a duel? "Not yet," Comey replied. Micah explained that Hamilton had won the Tony for Best Choreography, which, in the lawmaker's fertile mind, makes the musical just like Comey's statement recommending no prosecution of Clinton. "A case of choreography," he alleged, "between President Obama, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and Comey." Micah displayed a Clinton timeline with photos to tie his conspiracy together. "There's something fishy about this," Micah announced, between clicks of his tongue. "I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there are a lot of questions on how this came down." Comey, who otherwise endured nearly 5 hours of questioning with patience and calm, denounced the insinuation Micah had made and told him what he should tell his constituents. "Look me in the eye and listen to what I'm about to say," the FBI chief said. "I did not coordinate that statement with anyone. The White House, the Department of Justice, nobody outside the FBI family had any idea what I was about to say. I say that under oath. I stand by that. There was no coordination. No." Republicans didn't just disagree with Comey's decision or demand new investigations, which is their right. They alleged that this justice system is rigged and corrupt. "This doesn't hurt Comey or even Clinton as much as it undermines a building block of civilized society, the rule of law." Until now, nobody questioned the probity of Comey, a longtime prosecutor and former number two official in George W. Bush's Justice Department. House Speaker Paul Ryan had said his integrity is unequaled. Representative Jason Chavez Republican of Utah, chairman of the oversight panel, had said he and his Republican colleagues would probably accept his recommendation because, in all of government, he is a man of integrity and honesty. But now Ryan is saying Clinton got preferential treatment, Chavitz said. Comey made a political calculation, and presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump alleges the attorney general was bribed. Republicans could simply accept the political gift Comey presented them. He said Thursday that Clinton met the very definition of negligent in her mishandling of classified information, and he portrayed her as a Luddite who lacked basic familiarity with the treatment of classified material and didn't even have a computer in her office. They could also use the occasion to fix a system that classifies it too much, but still doesn't protect the most important secrets. Clinton is hardly the only one to mishandle government secrets. In the same hearing room 4 years ago, Chavitz publicly exposed the existence of a CIA facility in Benghazi. The Obama administration has repeatedly complained that members of the committee have divulged the names of U.S. government informants, airport security details, and information from a sealed wiretap warrant. Instead, several Republicans attempted to impugn the character of a model public servant. Obviously, this is very suspicious. Just the optics of it all, charged Representative Jody Heiss, Republican of Georgia. Tying Comey's announcement to Secretary Clinton is flying around in Air Force One with the president. Representative Buddy Carter, Republican of Georgia, said an inside-the-beltway mentality was keeping him from bringing charges. Comey, who delivered the opening statement and fielded questions without notes, calmly explained that to prosecute Clinton, the government would have to rely on a 1917 statute of dubious constitutionality that has only been used once in 99 years. Comey said that his all-star team of 15 to 20 people who didn't give a hoot about politics was unanimous after their year-long probe that Clinton should not be charged. He said they couldn't prove that she knew she was receiving classified information or retaining it on her server. And because the facts of the case wouldn't be used to prosecute a John Doe, he said trying to prosecute Clinton with these facts would be celebrity hunting. That, of course, is what Republicans wanted Comey to do. Instead, he showed integrity. In my experience, which is 3 decades, no reasonable prosecutor would bring this case, he said. I know that frustrates people, but that's the way the law is. Pardon me. We'll move now to the obituaries for today. Jean Cheryl Creek, age 88, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, July 9th, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. The family has chosen to have a celebration of life for Jean at a later date. Private family burial will be in Camp Butler Cemetery in Springfield with her husband. Memorials may be directed to WILL AM-FM TV, Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunications, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801, or the donor's choice. The family of Jean Cheryl Creek is being served by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, 2091 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur. And you may view the online obituary and send condolences to the family through their website. Greg R. Freeman, age 29, of Mount Zion, passed away Sunday, July 10th, 2016, at his home. Services to celebrate the life of Greg Freeman will be at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, July 14th, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 13th, at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the Humane Society of Decatur and Macon County. Anna Margaret Mitchell, age 92, of Olney, died Sunday, July 10th at Brookstone Estates. Services will be 11 a.m. Wednesday in St. Paul United Methodist Church, Olney, with visitation 1 hour before services. Burial will be in Dundas Cemetery. Kistler Patterson Funeral Home in Olney is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be made to St. Paul United Methodist Church or Hospice of Southeastern Illinois. And you may send condolences to the website at kistler-patterson.com. Paul Edwin Mullinax, age 94, of St. Marie, an Army veteran and retired geologist, died Saturday, July 9th. Massive Christian burial tomorrow, Wednesday, at 10 a.m. at St. Mary of the Assumption Catholic Church, St. Marie. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. today, and also 1 hour before services in the church. The burial will be at St. Mary's Cemetery, St. Marie, with military rites. Arrangements are being handled by Mayor Funeral Home in Newton. Marvin G. Spitzer, age 89, of Decatur, died Sunday, July 10th, 2016. Burial services will be at 3 p.m. Wednesday, July 13th, at Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home, with visitation from 1 p.m. until the service time. Burial will be in the Graceland Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Alan L. Stickle of Decatur, age 75, passed away Saturday, July 9th at Heartland Manor Care. Services to celebrate the life of Alan Stickle will be from 10 a.m. to 12 noon Wednesday, July 13th at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be donated to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, 501 St. Jude Place, Memphis, Tennessee. And that concludes the death notices for today. Yeah. And let's move now to more news. With this headline, state drops new test for high schoolers. The Illinois State Board of Education is backing away from a new standardized test for high school students after just 2 years. The board announced Monday that the SAT college entrance exam will be given free of charge to all high school juniors during the 2016-17 school year in place of the controversial Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers exam, known as PARC. The new test, which was designed to align with the new Common Core learning standards being adopted in Illinois and nearly every other state, was first given in the spring of 2015 and was met with criticism from students, parents, teachers, and school administrators alike. District and school administrators overwhelmingly agree with ISBE that every high school junior should have access to a college entrance exam, a policy that promotes equity and access and that provides each and every student with greater opportunities in higher education, State Superintendent of Education Tony Smith said. The SAT is aligned with the Illinois learning standards and will continue to empower educators to measure college and career readiness. Schools were already prepared to give the SAT after the state switched away from the rival ACT exam, which was long given as part of the Prairie State Achievement Exam, PARC's predecessor. As a result of Monday's announcement, high school juniors will take just one test as part of the statewide assessment. Many local school superintendents were critical of the PARC exam from the start, and their statewide organization hailed Monday's announcement as the right decision for students. This will help alleviate the overtesting of students, save valuable classroom time for instruction and learning, and also give us useful data regarding where our students stand regarding college and career readiness, said Brent Clark, Executive Director of the Illinois Association of School Administrators. Mike Chamness, a spokesman for the association, said one of the most encouraging points about the board's decision is that it was based on student-centered input from teachers and others on the front lines of education. It's good to see a state agency respond in that way, Chamness said. In its first year, the PARC exam, which is largely given online, was plagued by technology problems and by thousands of students refusing to take the test. The Illinois House even passed a bill this spring that would create ground rules for parents who want their students to opt out. The PARC exam will still be given to students in third through eighth grade. And we have one letter to the editor today in the mailbag. This is from Mike Griffin of Decatur, and the headline is, "Details of Governor's Turnaround Agenda Now Clear." I took Bob Long's advice and visited my proctologist, only to find Rauner is much worse than I thought. He is successful, but made a large share of his gold destroying Illinois jobs and wreaking havoc on workers and their families. As a vulture capitalist and parasite, he outsources jobs overseas and formed a company to aid other companies to do the same. Rauner was elected, but so was the legislature, and they are more representative of Illinoisans than a union buster who kept his agenda close to the cuff. While claiming workers were a special interest and to blame for our fiscal crisis, union-free zones violate federal law. When you are a greedy narcissist, what's a few laws? A local Republican representative in a town hall meeting said he was not supportive of Rauner's agenda and that unions were not the problem. He said, 90% of Illinois corporations pay no taxes. Rauner never exposed the fine details of his turnaround agenda. Rolling back regulations that protect the public and workers is part of that agenda. Trust Bruce and you will have a love canal in every neighborhood, workers dying on the job more frequently, and injured workers living in unbelievable poverty. More telling is his affiliation with the Koch brothers and hedge fund manager Ken Griffin, and the money he has amassed to fund dishonest TV ads. Rauner's goal is to turn Illinois red and follow the Karl Rove playbook, who is funded by the Kochs and the National Chamber of Commerce. Fellow Republicans who have defied his agenda have been bashed by ads he paid for. Rauner wants to lower wages and take away collective bargaining. I made you an appointment, Bob. And again, this letter was written by Mike Griffin of Decatur. And we have an opinion by Esther Sapita, headlined, "Asian Americans Can't Escape Pigeonhole." It has been nearly a year since the Pew Research Center reported that Asian Americans are elbowing Latin Americans aside and are projected to become the largest immigrant group by 2055. Policy analysis on the implications of this shift is beginning to trickle out. There are two important issues that Asian Americans have been trying to call attention to for years: the harm of the model minority myth, and the invisibility of various Asian subgroups and their unique needs when they are all grouped together as an Asian community. Gerard Robinson, an American Enterprise Institute fellow, recently highlighted how the stereotype of Asian students as academic superstars is not only indeed a myth, it also hides real achievement issues for at-risk populations. This isn't to say that many Asian Americans aren't high achievers. As Robinson wrote in A Tale of Two Disparity Gaps on the blog of the Brookings Institution White Students on the blog of the Brookings Institution, this is the quote, white students' math and writing SAT scores were 64 and 18 points lower than Asians in 2015. In fact, the combined SAT score of 1654 for Asians in 2015 saw a 54-point increase since 2006. Whites and others saw a decline during the same time. And that's the end of the quote. The problem is not that all Asian students are alike. It seems preposterous to even have to articulate this, but much like the so-called Latino community, the U.S. Asian population is wildly diverse in terms of country of origin, immigration status, education level, English language proficiency, and socioeconomic status. Despite the folklore of the tiger mom overscheduling her cubs into success, Robinson notes that many Asian students struggle in English language learning, reading, and math classes, including some from higher income households. In regard to an intra-Asian dynamic, Hmong, Tongan, and Vietnamese populations, for example, are among the most poorly educated communities in the United States, not just within the Asian community. In fact, some Black and Hispanic students outperform these populations, as well as some higher-achieving Asian students. Erroneously assuming that certain groups are high achievers inevitably results in other communities of need getting this short shrift on interventions and supports. For instance, when policymakers look at the white minority achievement gap, poor whites who live in the same type of poverty that stunts the academic growth of poor Black and Hispanic students tend to get lost in the shuffle. The blind spot is huge. According to census figures, there is a 10% poverty rate among white non-Hispanics. In raw numbers of people, impoverished whites are approximately twice the size of African Americans in poverty. The group with the highest rate of economic hardships, 25.8%. Similarly, when Asians are seen only as a homogeneous group of academic high achievers and not as a diverse population that includes immigrants from impoverished countries and refugees from war-torn regions, those who need support are overlooked. And because Asian students might not be concentrated in highly segregated or impoverished communities and school districts, they're unlikely to be targeted for help the way Hispanic and Black students are. For Asians of all ages, the remedy lies in demographic data disaggregation, a clunky term that has not captured the general population's imagination, but is seen as an effective way to change the narrative of the prototypical Asian. In California, where the Asian American population grew by 34% between 2000 and 2010, Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander civil rights organizations are advancing a bill that would require California's public institutions of higher education and public health to collect, analyze, and report data for up to 42 subgroups of those three broad categories. Civil rights groups there know that the disparities among national origin groups are stark. For example, without more nuanced collection and reporting of subgroup data, differences such as those between adult Chinese and Vietnamese elders, who have the most chronic health conditions, and Japanese elders, who have the least, may potentially mask the reality that Japanese women are nearly twice as likely to die of cancer as Asian Indian women. Correspondingly, adding more racial subcategories on nationwide standardized tests and breaking out performance data by subgroup could bring to light the diversity of the young Asian population's academic successes and struggles. Ultimately, fully understanding the fastest growing racial population in the country isn't some insurmountable dream. It's not rocket science, but it does require a societal will to choose to see this collective of Chinese ethnic groups as diverse and multifaceted, rather than a homogeneous and monolithic. And let's move now to this next editorial, and it is headlined, What Others Are Saying, FOIA, FOIA at 50 is slow and creaky. In 1953, newspaper attorney Harold Cross authored the report titled The People's Right to Know, in which he made the case for government transparency. Public business is the public's business, he wrote. Freedom of information is their just heritage. His report came out amid Cold War paranoia and heightened government secrecy when Washington had gone so far as to classify the amount of peanut butter the United States forces consumed. But Cross's efforts, alongside the advocacy of Congressman John Moss, led President Lyndon B. Johnson on July 4, 1966, to sign a law guaranteeing the public's right to obtain government information, the Freedom of Information Act. This month, the Freedom of Information Act turned 50. Over the past half century, the act has been instrumental in revealing government overreach and negligence, and it has provided a vital tool for scholars seeking to correct the historical record. But freedom of information remains plagued by problems, crippling delays, hefty fees, and outdated technology, not to mention expansive loopholes that federal agencies routinely exploit to deny legitimate requests. The statistics are staggering. Government agencies deny nearly half of all applications, and they heavily redact many of the documents they do release. In 2014, they improperly withheld an estimated 154,750 requests, and the backlog soared to a record 159,741 requests. At least one has been pending for 23 years. These problems stem from obvious and flexible flaws. The first is federal agencies' poor use of technology. In 2008, a survey of government agencies found that none kept consistent electronic records. Today, agencies still print and physically file emails to keep a record of them. A second is a lack of oversight. Different agencies exercise broad discretion in responding to Freedom of Information requests, and there is no independent organization to enforce consistency. In 2015, for example, Human Rights Watch requested identical information from each branch of the armed forces. The Air Force demanded $168,316 in processing fees. The Army asked for $1,584. The final problem is the ease with which the agencies can refuse legitimate requests. Under Exemption 5, also known as the Withhold It Because You Want To rule, agencies can suppress internal communications that would be inconvenient or incriminating, or simply difficult to process, on the grounds that they constitute an interagency or intra-agency communication or draft. Of course, agencies sometimes have legitimate reasons for withholding information, national security, for example. Yet too often, agencies err on the side of excessive secrecy. In 2014, agencies cited exemptions more than 55,000 times. In June, President Barack Obama signed a bill designed to close some of these loopholes. Under the bill, agencies are allowed to withhold information only when there is a foreseeable harm in releasing it. The bill prevents agencies from using Exemption 5 for information older than 25 years, and it creates a centralized online portal for all Freedom of Information requests. But there's more to be done. The bill does not authorize any new funding to help agencies comply with the amendments, even though they need money to process backlog request, hire new officers, and invest in record keeping. Nor does the bill include penalties for agencies that miss deadlines. What's needed ultimately is a shift in priorities. The Freedom of Information Act must become a central part of every agency's mission. Perhaps then it can truly live up to its promise, as Johnson articulated a half century ago. The United States is an open society in which the people's right to know is cherished and guarded. And that concludes the reading today for Tuesday, the 12th of July. This has been Susan reading with you, and I look forward to reading again with you very soon.